The Krays and the two new Schillers hummed away behind him, providing his monotonal recitative with a ground bass. These computers spent all their time running through one set of conditions after another, Sack said. But the results, while never the same, were seldom encouraging. The air was going to be cold and poisonous for a good while yet. Sax wandered down the hall, and John followed him into what looked like another lab, although there was a bed and a refrigerator in one corner. Violently disarranged bookscapes were overgrown with potted plants, bizarre Pleistocene growths that looked as deadly as the air outside. John sat in a lone, empty chair. Sax stood and looked down at a seashell shrub, as John described his meeting with Anne. "Do you think she's involved?" Sax said. "I think she may know who is. She mentioned someone called the Coyote." "Ah, yes." Sax glanced briefly at John, at his feet, to be precise. "She's sticking us onto a legendary character. He's supposed to have been on the Ares with us, you know. Hidden by Hiroko." John was so surprised that Sax had heard of the Coyote that it took him a while to figure out what else was disturbing about what he had said. But then it came to him. One night Maya had told him that she had seen a face, the face of a stranger. The voyage out had been hard on Maya, and he had discounted the tale. But now, Sax was wandering around, turning on lights, peering at screens, muttering about security measures. He opened the refrigerator door briefly, and John caught a glimpse of more spiky growths. Either he kept experiments in there, or else his snack food had suffered a truly virulent eruption of mold. John said, "You can see why most of the attacks have been on the Moholes. They're the easiest project to attack." Sax tilted his head to the side. "Are they? Think about it. Your little windmills are everywhere. There's nothing to be done about them." "People are disabling them. We've had reports." "What, a dozen? And how many are out there? 100,000? They're junk, Sax. Litter. Your worst idea." And nearly fatal to his project, in fact, because of the algae dishes Sax had hidden in some of them. All of that algae had died, apparently, but if it hadn't, and if anyone had been able to prove Sax had been responsible for its dissemination, he could have lost his job. It was yet another indication that Sax's logical manner was a front. Now his nose was wrinkled. "They add up to a terawatt a year. And knocking a few apart won't do anything to that. As for the other physical operations, the black snow algae is on the northern polar cap and can't be removed. The dawn and dusk mirrors are in orbit, and it's not so easy to knock them out. Someone did it to Pythagoras." "True, but we know who it was, and there's a security team following her. She may never lead them to anyone else. They may be able to afford to expend a person per act. I wouldn't be surprised." "Yeah, but simple changes in screening personnel would make it impossible for anyone to smuggle any tools aboard." "They could use what's out there." Sax shook his head. "The mirrors are vulnerable." "Okay. More than some projects, anyway. Those mirrors are adding 30 calories per square centimeter per soul," Sax said. "And more all the time." Almost all the freighters from Earth were sun sailors now, and when they arrived in the Martian system, they were linked to large collections of earlier arrivals parked in aerosynchronous orbit and programmed to swivel so that they reflected their light onto the terminators, adding a little bit of energy to each day's dawn and dusk. The whole arrangement had been coordinated by Sax's office, and he was proud of it. "We'll increase security for all the maintenance crews," John said. "So, increased security on the mirrors and at the Moholes." "Yes, but that's not all," Sax sniffed.
"What do you mean?"
"Well, the problem is that it isn't just the terraforming projects per se that are potential targets. I mean, the nuclear reactors are part of the project, too, in their way. They provide a lot of your power, and they're pumping out heat like the furnaces they are. If one of them were to go, it would cause all kinds of fallout, more political even than physical." The vertical lines between Sax's eyes reached up nearly to his hairline, John held out his palms. "Not my fault. That's just the way it is," Sack said. "AI, take a note. Look into reactor security." "Note taken," one of the shillers said, sounding just like Sack's. "And that's not the worst," John said. Sack's twitched, glared furiously at the floor. "The bioengineering labs." Sack's mouth became a tight line. "New organisms are being cooked up daily," John went on. "And it might be possible to create something that would kill everything else on the planet." Sack's blinked. "Let's hope none of these people think like you." "I'm just trying to think like them." "AI, take a note. Biolab security." "Of course, Vlad and Ursula and their group have stuck suicide genes into everything they've made," John said. "But those are meant to stop over-success or mutational accidents. If someone were to deliberately circumvent them and concoct something that fed on over-success, we could be in trouble." "I see that." "So, the labs, the reactors, the moholes, the mirrors." "It could be worse." Sacks rolled his eyes. "I'm glad you think so. I'll talk to Helmut about it. I'll be seeing him soon anyway. It looks like they're going to approve Phyllis's elevator at the next Unoma session. That will cut the costs of terraforming tremendously." "Eventually it will. But the initial investment must be huge." Sack shrugged. "Push an Amor asteroid into orbit. Set up a robot factory. Let it go to work. It's not as expensive as you might think." John rolled his eyes. "Sacks, who's paying for all this?" Sacks tilted his head, blinked. "The sun." John stood, suddenly hungry. "Then the sun calls the shots. Remember that." Mangalavid broadcast 6 hours of local amateur video every evening, a weird grab bag of stuff that John watched every chance he got. So after building a big green salad in the kitchen, he went to the window room on the dorm floor and watched while eating, glancing from time to time at the florid sunset over Ascreus. The first 10 minutes of that evening's broadcast had been shot by a sanitary engineer working on a waste processing plant in Chasma Borealis. Her voiceover was enthusiastic but boring. "What's nice is we can pollute all we want with certain materials, oxygen, ozone, nitrogen, argon, steam, some biota, which gives us leeway we didn't have back home. We just keep grinding what they give us till we can let it loose." Back home, John said to himself, a newcomer. After her, there was an attempt at a karate bout, both hilarious and beautiful at the same time, and then 20 minutes of some Russians staging Hamlet in pressure suits at the bottom of the Tarina Patera Mohole, a production that struck John as crazy until Hamlet caught sight of Claudius kneeling to pray, and the camera tilted up to show the mohole as cathedral walls, rising above Claudius to an infinitely distant shaft of sunlight, like the forgiveness he would never receive. John shut off the TV and took the elevator down to the dorm. He got into bed and relaxed. Karate as ballet. The newcomers were all still engineers, construction workers, scientists of all kinds. But they didn't seem as single-minded as the first 100. And that was probably good. They still had a scientific mindset and world view. They were practical, empirical, rational. One could hope that the selection process on Earth was still working against fanaticism, sending up people with a kind of traveling Swiss sensibility, practical but open to new possibilities, able to form new loyalties and beliefs, or so he hoped. He knew by now it was a bit naive. You only had to look at the first 100 to realize scientists could become as fanatical as anybody else, maybe more so. Education's too narrowly focused, perhaps. Hiroko's team disappearing. Out there in the wild rock somewhere, lucky bastards. He fell asleep. He worked at Eckes Overlook a few days more, then got a call from Helmut Bronski and Burrows, who wanted to confer with him about the new arrivals from Earth. John decided to take the train to Burrows and see Helmut in person. The night before his departure, he went to see Sachs in his labs. When he walked in, Sachs said in his monotone, "We've found an Amor asteroid that's 90% ice in an orbit that will bring it near Mars in 3 years. Just what I've been looking for, in fact." His plan was to place a robot-controlled mass driver on an ice asteroid and push it into an aero-braking orbit around Mars, thus burning it up in the atmosphere. This would satisfy UNOMA protocols forbidding the kind of mass destruction that a direct impact would cause, but it would still add massive quantities of water and separated hydrogen and oxygen to the atmosphere, thickening it with precisely the gases they needed most. It could raise the atmospheric pressure by as much as 50 millibars. You're kidding! The pre-arrival average at the datum had been between 7 and 10 millibars. Earth's sea level averaged 1,013. And all their efforts so far had only raised the average to around 50. One ice ball will double the atmospheric pressure? That's what the simulations indicate. Of course, with the initial level so low, doubling is not as impressive as it sounds. Still, that's great, Sachs, and it'll be hard to sabotage. But Sachs didn't want to be reminded of that. He frowned slightly and slipped away. John laughed at his skittishness and went to the door. Then he stopped to think and looked up and down the hall. Empty, and no video monitors in Sachs's offices. He went back in, grinning at his own furtive tiptoes, and glanced around at the paper chaos on Sachs's desk. Where to start? Presumably his AI would be the repository of anything interesting, but probably it would only respond to Sachs's voice and would surely keep a record of any other inquiries. Quietly he opened a desk drawer. Empty. All the drawers in the desk were empty. He almost laughed out loud, stifled it. There was a stack of correspondence on a lab bench, and he picked through it. Mostly notes from the biologists at Acheron. At the bottom of the stack was a single sheet of unsigned mail with no return address or origin code. Sachs's printer had spit it out without any identification that John could see. The message was brief. 1. We use suicide genes to curb proliferation. 2. There are so many heat sources now on the surface that we don't think anyone can tell our exhaust from the rest of it. 3. We simply agreed we wanted to get off and work on our own, without interference. I'm sure you understand now. After a minute of staring at this, John whipped his head up and looked around. Still alone. He glanced at the note again, put it back where he had found it, and walked quietly out of Sachs's offices back to the guest quarters. "Sachs," he said admiringly. "You tricky Congress of rats." The train to Burrows carried mostly freight. 30 narrow cars of it, with 2 passenger cars up front, running over a superconducting magnetic piste so quickly and smoothly that it was hard to believe the view. After John's endless plods cross-country in rovers, it was almost frightening. The only thing to do was flood the pleasure centers in the old brain with Omegendorf and sit back and enjoy it, looking out at what appeared to be some kind of terrain-following supersonic flight. The piste had been routed roughly parallel to the 10-degree north latitude. Eventually the plan was to ring the planet, but so far only the hemisphere between Eckes and Burrows had been finished. Burrows had become the biggest town in the far hemisphere. The original settlement had been built by an American-based consortium using a French-led EC design, and was located at the upper end of Isidus Planitia, which was in effect a huge trough where the northern plains made a deep indentation into the southern highlands. The sides and head of the trough counteracted the planet's curvature in such a way that the landscape around the town had something like Terran horizons, and as the train flew down the great trough, Boone could see across mesa-dotted dark plains to horizons some 60 kilometers away. Burroughs's buildings were almost all cliff dwellings, cut into the sides of 5 low mesas that were grouped together on a rise in the bend of an ancient curving channel. Big sections of the mesa's vertical sides had been filled by rectangles of mirrored glass, as if postmodern skyscrapers had been turned on their sides and shoved into the hills. A startling sight, in fact, and far more impressive than Underhill or even Eckes Overlook, which had a great view but couldn't be seen. No, the glass-sided mesas of Burroughs, on their rise over a channel that seemed to be begging for water, with a view out to distant hills. These features combined to give the new town a quickly growing reputation as the most beautiful city on Mars. Its western train station was inside one of the excavated mesas, a glass-walled room 60 meters high. John stepped out into this grand space and made his way through the crowds of people, head craned back like a hick in Manhattan. Train crews were dressed in blue jumpers, prospecting teams in Walker Green, Unoma bureaucrats in suits, construction workers in work jumpers colored like rainbows to suggest sportswear. Unoma headquarters had been located in Burroughs 3 years before, causing a real building boom. It was a close thing whether there were more Unoma bureaucrats or construction workers in the station. At the far end of the great room, John found a subway entrance and took a little subway car to the Unoma headquarters. In the car, he shook hands with a few people who recognized and approached him, feeling the old weirdness of the fishbowl return. He was back among strangers, in a city. That night, he had dinner with Helmut Bronski. They had met many times before, and John was impressed by the man, a German millionaire who had gotten into politics. Tall, beefy, blonde, and red-faced, impeccably groomed, dressed in an expensive gray suit. He had been the EC's Minister of Finance when he took the Unoma post. Now he told John the latest news in a very urbane British English, eating roast beef and potatoes rapidly between bursts of sentences, holding his silverware in the workmanlike German fashion. "We are going to award a prospecting contract in Elysium to the transnational consortium Armscor. They will be shipping up their own equipment." "But Helmut," John said, "won't that violate the Mars Treaty?" Helmut made a wide gesture with the hand holding the fork. They were men of the world, his look said. They understood these kinds of things. "The treaty is superannuated. This is obvious to everyone dealing with the situation. But its scheduled revision is 10 years away. In the meantime, we have to try to anticipate certain aspects of the revision. That's why we give some concessions now. There is no rational reason to delay. And if we tried, there would be trouble in the General Assembly." "But the General Assembly can't be happy that you've given the first concession to an old South African weapons manufacturer." Helmut shrugged. "Armscor has very little relation to its origins. It is just a name. When South Africa became Azania, the company moved its home offices to Australia, and then to Singapore. And now, of course, it has become very much more than an aerospace firm. It is a true transnational, one of the new tigers, with banks of its own and controlling interest in about 50 of the old Fortune 500.
50 of them? John said.
"Yes, and Armscor is one of the smallest of the transnationals. That is why we picked it. But it still has a bigger economy than any but the largest 20 countries. As the old multinationals coalesce into transnationals, you see, they really gather quite a bit of power, and they have influence in the General Assembly. When we give one a concession, some 20 or 30 countries profit by it and get their opening on Mars. And for the rest of the countries, that serves as a precedent. And so pressure on us is reduced."
"Uh-huh." John thought it over. "Tell me, who negotiated this agreement?"
"Well, it was a number of us, you know."
Helmut ate on, serenely ignoring John's steady gaze. John pursed his lips, looked away. He understood suddenly that he was talking with a man who, though a functionary, considered himself to be vastly more important on the planet than Boone. Genial, smooth-faced, and who cut his hair? Bronski leaned back and ordered them after-dinner drinks. His assistant, their waitress for the evening, scurried off to oblige.
"I don't believe I've been waited on before on Mars," John observed.
Helmut met his gaze calmly, but his beefy color had heightened. John almost smiled. The Unoma factor wanted to seem menacing, the representative of powers so sophisticated that John's little weather station mentality couldn't even comprehend them. But John had found in the past that a few minutes of his first man on Mars routine was usually enough to crush that kind of attitude. So he laughed and drank and told tales and alluded to secrets only the first 100 were privy to, and made it clear to the assistant waitress that he was the one in command at the table, and so on, behaving in general in an unconcerned, knowing, arrogant manner. And by the time they were finished with their sherbet and brandy, Bronski was loud and blustery himself, clearly nervous and on the defensive. Functionaries. John had to laugh. But he was curious concerning the ultimate point of their conference, which still wasn't clear to him. Perhaps Bronski had wanted to see in person how news of the new concession would affect one of the first 100, perhaps to gauge the reaction of the rest. That would be silly, for to get a good gauge on the first 100, you would need to poll 80 of them at least. But that didn't mean it wasn't true. John was used to being taken for a representative of things, for a symbol, the figurehead again. It could definitely be a waste of time. He wondered if he could salvage something of his own from the evening, and as they were walking back to his guest suite, he said, "Have you ever heard of the coyote?"
"An animal?"
He grinned, left it at that. In his room, he lay on his bed, Mangalavid on the TV, thinking things over. Brushing his teeth before going to sleep, he looked his mirror image in the eye and scowled. He waved his toothbrush in the expansive gesture.
"Well," he said in an unfair parody of Helmut's slight accent, "this is business, you know."
Business as usual. The next morning he had a few hours before his first meeting, and so he spent the time with Pauline, going over what he could find out about Helmut Bronski's doings in the last 6 months. Could Pauline get into the Unoma diplomatic pouch? Had Helmut ever been to Senzeni Na or any of the other sabotage sites? While Pauline ran through her search algorithms, John swallowed an Omegendorf to kill his hangover and thought about what lay behind this inspiration to search Helmut's records. Unoma constituted the ultimate authority on Mars these days, at least according to the letter of the law. In practice, as last night had made clear, it had the UN's usual toothlessness before national armies and transnational money. Unless it did their bidding, it was helpless. It couldn't succeed against their desires and probably would never even try, as it was their tool. So what did they want, the national governments and the transnational boards of directors? If enough sabotages occurred, would that constitute a reason to bring in more of their own security? Would it tend to increase their control? He made a disgusted noise. Apparently, the only result of his investigation so far was that the list of suspects had tripled. Pauline said, "Excuse me, John," and the information came up on her screen. The diplomatic pouch she had found was coded in one of the new unbreakable encryptions. You'd have to get the decryptions to enter it. Helmut's movements, on the other hand, were easily traceable. He had been to Pythagoras, the mirror station that had been spun out of orbit 10 weeks ago, and to Senzeni Na 2 weeks before John's visit, and yet no one at Senzeni Na had mentioned his appearance. Most recently, he had just returned from the mining complex being set up at a place called Bradbury Point. 2 days later, John left to visit it. Bradbury Point was located some 800 kilometers north of Burrows, at the easternmost extension of the Nila Syrtis Mensae. The Mensae were a series of long mesas, like islands of the southern highlands standing out in the shallows of the northern plains. The island mesas of Nyla Syrtis had recently been found to be a rich metallogenic province with deposits of copper, silver, zinc, gold, platinum, and other metals. Concentrations of ore like this had been discovered in several locations on the so-called Great Escarpment, where the southern highlands drop to the northern lowlands. Some areologists were going so far as to label the entire escarpment region a metallogenic province, banding the planet like the stitching on a baseball. It was another odd fact to add to the great north-south mystery, and a fact that was, of course, getting more than its share of attention. Excavations, accompanied by intensive areological studies, were being conducted by scientists working for UNOMA and, John discovered as he checked new arrivals' employment records, the transnationals, all trying to find clues that would enable them to locate more deposits. But even on Earth, the geology of mineral formation was not well understood, which was why prospecting still had large elements of chance in it. And on Mars, it was more mysterious yet. The recent finds on the Great Escarpment had been mostly an accident, and only now was the region becoming the main focus for prospecting. The discovery of the Bradbury Point complex had accelerated this hunt, as it was turning out to be as big as the largest Terran complexes, perhaps the equal of the Buchfeldt complex of Azania. So, a gold rush in Nyla Syrtis. And Helmut Bronski had visited the scene, which turned out to be small and utilitarian, a mere beginning. A rickover and some refineries next to a mesa hollowed out and filled by a habitat. The mines were scattered in the lowlands between mesas. Boone drove up to the habitat, coupled to the garage, then ducked through the locks. Inside, a welcoming committee greeted him and took him up to a window-walled conference room to talk. There were, they said, about 300 people in Bradbury, all employees of UNOMA and trained by the transnational Shalalco. When they took John on a brief tour, he found they were a mix of ex-South Africans, Australians, and Americans, all happy to shake his hand. About three-quarters men, pale and clean, looking more like lab techs than the blackened trolls John envisioned when he heard the word miner. Most of them were working on 2-year contracts, they told him, and keeping track of the time they had left by the week or even by the day. They ran the mines mostly by teleoperation and looked shocked when Boone asked to go down into a mine for a look around. "It's just a hole," one said. Boone stared at them innocently, and after another moment's hesitation, they scrambled to gather an escort team to take him out. It took them 2 hours to get into walkers and out a lock. They drove to the rim of a mine, and then down a ramp road into a terraced oval pit some 2 kilometers long. There they got out and followed John as he walked around. Surrounded by big robotic dozers and dump trucks and earth movers, his 4 escorts' faceplates were all eyes, on the alert for a behemoth on the loose, John guessed. He stared at them, amazed at their timidity. It made him realize all of a sudden that Mars could be just another version of the hardship assignment, a hellish combination of Siberia, the interior of Saudi Arabia, the South Pole in winter, and Novi Mir. Or else they just thought he was a dangerous man to be around, which gave him a start. Everyone had no doubt heard of the falling dump truck. Maybe it was just that. But could it be something more? Might these people be aware of something that he wasn't? Reflecting on this for a while, John found his own eyes beginning to press glass. He had been thinking of the falling truck as an accident, or at least something that could only happen once. But his movements were easy to trace. Everyone knew where he was. And every time you went outdoors, you were only a walker away, as they said. And in a pit mine, there were a lot of behemoths about. But they got back in without incident. And that night they had the usual dinner and party in his honor, a hard-drinking party with a lot of Omegendorf consumption and loud, raucous talk. A bunch of young, tough engineers, pleased to find that John Boone was actually a fun guy to party with. A fairly common reaction among newcomers, especially younger men. John chatted them up and had a good time, and slipped his inquiries into the flow pretty unnoticeably, he thought. They hadn't heard of the coyote, which was interesting, as they did know about Big Man and the hidden colony. Apparently the coyote was not in that category of tale. He was some kind of insider thing, known, so far as John could tell, only to some of the first hundred. The miners had had a recent unusual visit, however. An Arab caravan had come by, traveling the edge of Vastidis Borealis. And, they said, the Arabs had claimed to have been visited by some of the lost colonists, as they called them. Interesting, John said. It seemed unlikely to him that Hiroko or any of her crew would reveal themselves, but who could tell? He might as well go check it out. After all, there was only so much he could do at Bradbury Point. Very little detective work, he was noticing, could be accomplished before a crime occurred. So he spent a couple more days observing the mining. But that only reinforced his shock at the scale of the operation, at how much robotic earth movers could tear away. "What are you going to do with all the metal?" he asked, after taking a look down into another great open pit mine, located 25 kilometers to the west of the habitat. "Getting it to earth will cost more than it's worth, won't it?" The chief of operations, a black-haired man with a hatchet face, grinned. "We'll hold on to it until it's worth more, or until they build that space elevator." "You believe in that?" "Oh yeah, the materials are there. Graphite whisker reinforced with diamond spirals. Why, you could almost build one on Earth with that. Here it would be easy." John shook his head. That afternoon they drove for an hour back to the habitat, past raw pits and slag heaps, toward the distant plume of the refineries on the other sides of the habitat mesa. He was used to seeing the land torn up for building purposes, but this, it was amazing what a few hundred people could do. Of course, it was the same technology that was allowing Sachs to build a vertical town the whole height of the Ekus Overlook, the same technology that allowed all the new towns to be built so quickly. But still, wreaking such havoc just to strip away metals, destined for Earth's insatiable demand. The next day, he gave the operations chief a fiendishly tight security regimen to be followed for 2 months. Then he drove out into the wind-eroded tracks of the Arab caravan and followed them north and east. It turned out that Frank Chalmers was traveling with this Arab caravan, but he hadn't seen or heard of any visitation by Hiroko's people, and none of the Arabs would admit to being the one who had told the story at Bradbury Point. A false lead, then, or else one that Frank was helping the Arabs to eliminate. And if so, how would John find that out? Though the Arabs had only recently arrived on Mars, they were already Frank's allies, no doubt about it. He lived with them, he spoke their language, and now, naturally, he was the constant mediator between them and John. Not a chance of an independent investigation, except what Pauline could do in the records, which she could do as well away from the caravan as in it. Nevertheless, John traveled with them for a while as they roamed the Great Dune Sea, doing areology and a bit of prospecting. Frank was only there briefly himself, to talk to an Egyptian friend. He was too busy to stay anywhere for long. His job as U.S. Secretary made him as much of a globetrotter as John, and they crossed paths pretty frequently. Frank had managed to keep his position as the American department head now through 3 administrations, even though it was a cabinet post, a remarkable feat, even without considering his distance from Washington. And so he was now overseeing the introduction of investment by the American-based transnationals, a responsibility that made him manic with overwork and puffed up with power, what John thought of as the business version of Sachs, always moving, always gesturing with his hands as if conducting the music of his speech, which had shifted over the years to full-tilt Chamber of Commerce overdrive. "Gotta stake a claim on the escarpment before the transnats and the Germans snap everything up. Lot of work to be done," which was his constant refrain. Often said while pointing for illustration at the little globe he carried with him in his lectern pocket, Look at your moholes. I just entered them last week, one near the North Pole, 3 in the 60s north and south, 4 along the equator, 4 bracketing the South Pole. All of them nicely placed west of volcanic rises to catch their updrafts. It's beautiful.
He spun the globe, and the blue dots marking the moholes blurred for a moment into blue lines.
It's good to see you finally doing something useful.
Finally.
Look, here's the new habitat factory in Hellas. They're manufacturing starter units at a rate that'll enable them to handle some 3,000 emigrants per LS-90, and given the new fleet of round-trip shuttles, that's just barely enough.
He saw John's expression and said quickly,
All heat in the end, John, so it helps the terraforming with more than just money and labor. I mean, think about it.
But do you ever wonder what's going to come of it all? John asked.
What do you mean?
You know, this deluge of people and equipment while things are falling apart on Earth.
Things are always going to be falling apart on Earth. You might as well get used to it.
Yeah, but who's going to own what up here? Who's going to call the shots? Frank just made a face at John's naivete, at the very nature of the question. One look at his grimace, and John could read it all, the whole complex of disgust and impatience and amusement. A part of John was pleased at this instant recognition. He knew his old friend better than he had ever known any of his family, so that the swarthy, pale-eyed face glowering at him was like that of a brother, a twin that he couldn't ever remember not knowing. On the other hand, he was annoyed with Frank for his condescension.
People are wondering about it, Frank. It's not just me, and it's not just Arkady. You can't just shrug it off and act like it's a stupid question, like there's nothing to be decided.
The UN decides, Frank said brusquely.
There's 10 billion of them and 10,000 of us. That's 1,000,000 to 1. If you want to influence those kind of odds, you ought to have become the Unoma factor like I told you to when they set up the position. But you didn't listen to me. You just shrugged it off. You could have really done something. But now what are you? Sachs's assistant in charge of publicity.
And development, and security, and Terran affairs, and the moholes.
Ostrich, Frank pounced. Head in a hole. Come on, let's go eat.
John agreed, and they went off to a dinner in the Arab's biggest rover, a meal of basted lamb and dill-flavored yogurt, delicious and exotic. But John found himself still irritated at Frank's scorn, which never let up. The old rivalry, sharp as ever, and no first-man routine would ever make a dent in Frank's sneery arrogance. Thus, when Maya Toitovna showed up unexpectedly the next day, traveling west on her way to Acheron, John gave her a longer hug than he might have otherwise, and by the time that night's dinner was over, he had made certain that she would spend the night in his rover. A matter of a particular attentiveness, a certain laugh, a certain look, the near-accidental brushing of arms together as they stood trying sherbets, talking to the happy men of the caravan who clearly found her fascinating. All their old code of conciliation and seduction, established through the years. And Frank could only watch, deadpan, talking in Arabic to his Egyptian friends.